This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Lusam, The Dragon Mage Wars, Books 1 and 2. Written by Dean Catman, performed by Alex Windham. Lusam, Book 1. Chapter 1. The cold rain came down hard, driven by the strong northerly wind which had been blowing relentlessly for the past 3 days. Winter was definitely on its way, and Lusam knew it. If he did not find shelter soon, he would be in big trouble. Ever since his grandmother died 2 years ago, he had been forced to live the hard, unforgiving life of a street kid. Living on the streets was hard enough, but for a 12-year-old boy alone in a city like Helvile, where thieves and murderers were commonplace, it bordered on the impossible. Lusam spent the first 2 years after his grandmother had passed away living in the alley behind the baker's shop. For the most part, he only had to compete with the rats for scraps of burned or spoiled food thrown out by the baker or his wife. The dead-end alley also helped him shelter from the wind, and although meager, the baker's chimney gave off a small amount of heat, especially first thing in the morning when the ovens were lit to cook the daily bread. In fact, the only reason he had found the alley, which had undoubtedly saved his life that first year with its bitter cold winter, was that chimney. Almost starving, he had smelled the bread cooking from the chimney, and it had led him to that alley. Lusam found a small grate in the wall that first day, and had managed to crawl inside it, out of the worst of the cold. There wasn't much room to move inside, but at least it was dry, and the small space helped to retain a portion of his body heat. He didn't need a lot of room as it happened. Apart from his well-worn clothes, his only other possession was a small crystal amulet his grandmother had given him the day she had died. She had told him that his mother had entrusted it to her for safekeeping, and that she should give Lusam the amulet when he came of age. Lusam had tried to ask about the amulet and his mother, who he never really knew, but his grandmother was far too ill from the fever to be able to answer any of his questions. He had fully intended to ask her more in the morning, after she had rested, but he never had the opportunity, and she quietly passed away in her sleep that very night. Lusam had thought many times about selling the amulet to buy a little food, or even one night's warmth at an inn, but no matter how much he told himself he needed to sell it, he couldn't bring himself to part with it. It was the only thing he had left of his mother and grandmother in this world, and selling it for any reason seemed so wrong. So this small, insignificant hole behind the baker's shop became his home and safe retreat from the nighttime city for almost 2 years. One morning, stirring from his sleep, Lusam noticed an unusual smell. It was nothing like the mouth-watering smell of freshly baked bread to which he would normally awaken. At first he thought it part of the dream he was having. It's funny how the mind can take real sounds and smells and incorporate them into your dreams, making them all the more real. He was very comfortable this morning. An almost spring-like warmth surrounded him in his small living space, the likes of which he had not felt in months. He started drifting off, back into deeper sleep, dreaming of the summer evenings spent with his grandmother in the forest, cooking food over an open campfire with the stars overhead twinkling down on them. His grandmother had once told him that one of those stars was his mother watching over him while he slept each night, and that had given him great comfort in the cold, dark, lonely nights since he had found himself all alone in the world. As he was drifting deeper into sleep, he was startled awake by a cry of, "Help! Fire! Fire!" When he opened his eyes, he could not believe what he was seeing. The bakery was engulfed by flames, with thick black smoke billowing out of the windows and under the door. The flames leapt through the roof and high into the morning sky. As he started to take in the scene more, and his mind started to process the information through the haze of sleep, he noticed the heat inside his small grate increasing rapidly. He quickly removed the grill from the entrance and was about to poke his head out to take a better look when a large piece of burning timber landed directly in front of his face, bouncing twice down the alley before coming to rest in a shower of sparks. He knew he had to get out of there fast before the rest of the building came down on top of him. With a silent prayer to Aisha that no more of the building would come down on him while he was climbing out, he took a deep breath and wriggled out of the hole as fast as he could. When he was able to stand, he began to run as fast as he could towards the far end of the alley, away from the burning buildings. From behind him came a huge crash. As he looked back over his shoulder, he saw that the front of the building adjoining the bakery had collapsed right where he had been only seconds before, burying his great entrance in a mass of rubble and flames. As he stood watching the carnage unfold before his eyes, the cold realization suddenly hit him. He had lost yet another home. No matter how poor a home it had been, at least it had been his and had kept him dry. Then a second thought struck him with even more force. He had just lost his main food source, too. He had no idea how long he stood there, staring dumbfounded at the flames, while people were trying to contain the fire and save what they could, and the rats ran in all directions, fleeing for their lives. When Lusam finally regained some of his composure, he simply turned around and walked away from the relative safety of the alley and into the unforgiving streets of Helvil. 2 weeks had passed since the fire, and Lusam had spent most of that time cold, hungry, and tired. He sat on the edge of the fountain in the main square, listening to the water behind him cascading down a statue of some long-dead king. He watched the people walk past for hours, all busy in their own little worlds, never taking any notice of the street kid sitting on the small wall of the fountain watching them go by. He had hoped that the baker's shop would be repaired, and that he could go back to how it had been for the last 2 years. But the damage had been far too severe, and it had been pulled down instead. Life was much harder now. There were plenty of street kids in Helvil, but there was also a distinct hierarchy among them. Although Lusam had been in Helvil for the past 2 years, he had not associated himself with the street kids there much, so they didn't know him, and therefore he was a long way down the pecking order when it came to anything, especially food or work. Many of the street kids had to resort to theft on a daily basis simply to survive. If caught, they would be severely punished with a public whipping for their first offense and having a digit removed from their hand for any future crimes they committed. Many of the street kids had various numbers of digits missing. It seemed the older they were, the more they had lost. It was simply a choice: steal or starve. Lusam refused to resort to stealing anything. This was not because he was frightened of the consequences, although he didn't relish the thought of either type of punishment. When he had been a young boy, his grandmother had caught him taking a freshly baked biscuit without permission from the windowsill where they had been left cooling. She had been most vocal in her displeasure with him. Although obviously he never got whipped or lost a digit over the biscuit, he also never forgot the lesson she had taught him, that stealing was wrong in any form, and he had given his word to her that he would never steal anything ever again. While he sat there in the weak winter sunshine, he couldn't help but think about all the good things he used to enjoy doing with his grandmother. His favorite was when she would take him into the forest and teach him small tricks, like how to light a campfire with only a word, or how he could communicate with the animals. He remembered the time he asked her if they could talk back, but she explained that she wasn't really talking to them. She was simply projecting a feeling towards them. She could make a bird or a rabbit come right up to them by projecting a feeling of safety towards the animal. He practiced for hours until he could also do it. In fact, he got so good at it, he could summon several different creatures at the same time with little effort. He had used a similar method in the alley to keep away the rats at night. He would project the image of a hungry cat as if it was waiting behind the grate, ready for a tasty rat supper, and it seemed to have worked very well indeed. He did feel a little guilty about doing this sometimes, because he once asked his grandmother why she didn't just get the animals to come to them and catch them for their dinner, so they would always have meat for the table. She looked him straight in the eyes, and with that stern look she used to wear whenever she wanted him to know something was important, she had replied, "You should never betray the trust an animal gives you willingly or unwillingly. To use the power Aisha has given you in that way would dishonor her and yourself in equal measure, and that would not be wise in many ways, my child." She had also explained that all life had a force of magic running through and around it, and even some things that were not alive had a certain amount of magic within them. Each person had an amount of magic inside them. Most could neither sense it nor use it, but a gifted few could see it in others, and even fewer could use the power inside themselves to varying degrees. She taught Lusam to recognize the aura that glowed around everyone, and how he would notice it glow more intensely around the few who could use magic, and to be wary of such people if he did not know them. One of his favorite games as a young boy that he played with his grandmother was hide-and-seek in the forest. When they first played the game, he could never understand how his grandmother was able to find his hiding places so easily. When it was his turn to seek, sometimes it would take what seemed like forever to a young boy to find her, and many times he called out that he gave up and that she should come out of hiding. On one occasion, when they went to the forest and played the game, he had the idea of looking for his grandmother's aura instead of looking directly for her. He was amazed when he cleared his mind, concentrated, and searched using his mage sight instead of his natural sight, that he could spot her so easily, and from so far away, even through the trees. He soon realized how she had won the game so quickly in the past. He was about to suggest they did something different, as it would be far too easy to find each other now that he knew her secret. But then he had an idea. With a mischievous grin on his face, he told his grandmother he would go and hide, and not knowing he had discovered her secret, she readily agreed and started counting to the mandatory 100. Lusam ran a few hundred paces into the forest, just as he had done dozens of times before during his previous visits. He found a suitable hiding place and crouched down behind a large fallen tree. He closed his eyes, cleared his mind as he had been shown countless times, and he tried to hide his aura using magic. He had no idea if it would or even could work, but he had to try, then maybe he could win for once. He could see his grandmother stand up from her starting point and head directly for his hiding place using her mage sight. No, he thought to himself, and redoubled his efforts to hide his aura. It was a strange feeling he experienced, like a shutter had been lowered over the lantern that was his mind. He knew the light was still as bright behind the shutter, but no light escaped to the outside world. He saw his grandmother halt in mid-stride, and then start to look around frantically in all directions. He knew for certain at that point he had achieved his goal and smiled to himself, knowing he was at last going to win for a change. His grandmother stood still for a few more seconds before resuming her original line of interception. He was pretty sure she couldn't see his aura, so he presumed that she must just be heading toward the last place she had seen him. He was just about ready to accept defeat again when he had another idea. He concentrated on projecting his aura to a location about 50 paces to the east. He then set the image in his mind and released a short, sharp blast of power in that direction. Instantly, his grandmother turned to look to the east and then changed her direction to where he had projected his fake aura. Lusam by this time was chuckling to himself so hard he was surprised his grandmother didn't just hear him instead of see him. When she reached the place he had projected his aura, she stopped, then started scanning the ground all around her. Even at 50 paces, he could see the worry and concern on her face as she started calling out his name. Rules were rules, and the rule was if you didn't say the words, "I give up," you didn't reveal your location or you lost. And at the age of 7, rules were very important, almost as important as winning the game. After a few more minutes, his grandmother must have also remembered the rules, because she called out the correct phrase, indicating that Lusam had won the game and should come out of hiding. He did just that with a very loud whoop while jumping into the air over and over again. He also noticed the relief that washed over his grandmother's face when he emerged from his hiding place as she rushed over to hug him tightly.
I won! I won! I actually won this time!
Yes, you did indeed. Come, let's go sit by the fire. I need to talk with you, Lusam.
Lusam felt a little apprehensive as they headed the short distance back to their camp. He wondered if he was in big trouble for playing the trick on his grandmother. When they reached the camp and sat down, his grandmother sat there for what seemed like a very long time just looking at Lusam. Then eventually, she said in a calm voice,
"Lusam, how did you do that? How did you hide your aura from me?"
"I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make you angry with me. I won't do it again, I promise,"
he replied sheepishly.
"No, you don't understand, Lusam. What you just did is supposed to be impossible to achieve, and to my knowledge, I have never heard of it ever being done before. Could you do it again, here, now for me, please?"
she asked him. He looked up at her and nodded his head.
"Thank you, Lusam,"
she replied, watching his aura closely. He cleared his thoughts again and closed the shutter in his mind just as he had done before. This time it was much easier, because he knew exactly what he needed to do to achieve it. His grandmother brought her hand to her mouth, gasping out loud, and a small tear rolled down her cheek, dripping onto the back of her quivering hand.
"Are you all right, Grandmother?"
he asked, suddenly concerned.
"Oh, yes, Lucem. I'm more than all right, my boy,"
she replied, with a huge smile on her face. Later that evening, she asked him in more detail how he had done it, and she tried for a long time to hide her own aura with his help, but she was unable to do it, or even come close. One of the most vivid memories of his early years that had stayed with him right up until now were of that day in the forest. The simple things like winning a game or being able to do something an adult couldn't do. One conversation, however, stuck in his mind more than any other from that afternoon around the campfire. His grandmother took hold of his hand and looked deep into his eyes, then said,
"Lucem, I thank Aisha, for you have been doubly blessed. Not only can you use the power Aisha has granted you, but you can also now hide amongst the non-magi of this world."
He looked at her while his 7-year-old mind tried to process what she had just said.
"Hide? Why do I need to hide?"
"Oh, my boy, there is a lot of this world I must teach you. The lessons here in the forest you have learned well, surpassing anything I could have imagined. Many things I must teach you must wait until you are older, so you will understand them fully. I must ask something of you now, so it may help ensure that we do have the time that we will need for me to teach you all that I must. Promise me that you will use your newfound skill and shield your aura at all times, if possible even while you sleep. Can you promise me this, Lucem?"
"But why, Grandmother?"
"Please, Lucem, if you love me, you must promise me you will do it, for me and for you."
He looked at his grandmother's pleading expression and knew he had to agree, even if he didn't know the reasons why.
"I'll do it for you. Don't worry, Grandmother."
"Thank you, Lucem. It means so much for me to hear you say that,"
she said, taking a hold of him in her arms and hugging him so hard he could barely breathe. It was a good feeling, and he missed those times so much now he was older and all alone in the world. Thinking about all the good times he had as a child was all well and good, but it did little to relieve the discomfort coming from his stomach, as it loudly reminded him he had yet to eat anything today. Lucem had already been to the main gate earlier that morning. It was the place where all the street kids gathered each day, and where they all tried to gain some kind of work, for food or coin. Sometimes a rich nobleman may simply need information regarding the whereabouts of a certain building or person, or it could be something as disgusting as clearing out a blocked sewer pipe, or some other equally degrading job that nobody else in town wanted to do. All the people of Hellveal knew that the street kids gathered at the gate each morning, desperate for anything they could get, and so they knew exactly where to find the people to do the jobs that nobody else wanted to do in Hellveal. It was a long shot, but he stood up and headed back down to the city gates. Nobody would usually try to find street kids there at this time in the afternoon, because they knew they wouldn't be there. If the work didn't come in the early mornings, it didn't come at all, and the kids would have to try and eat by other, less reputable means. As he approached the gates, he noticed a pretty blonde girl about his own age already standing at the gate. Although her clothes were dirty, they were cleaner and in much better condition than his own attire. She wore green trousers and a brown tunic with sturdy-looking black boots, and her shoulder-length hair was neatly tied up in a ponytail. He had seen her the previous morning at the gate, but she had kept to herself and not really spoken with any of the other street kids waiting for work there. As he approached, she made brief eye contact with him, and when he nodded his head in greeting, she did the same in return.
"Hi there. Are you waiting for work, or are you just meeting someone here?"
he asked in his friendliest voice.
"Why'd you ask?"
she replied, with more than a hint of caution evident in her voice.
"Sorry, I was just trying to be polite. I didn't want to take any job you might be waiting for,"
Lucem said, smiling. The girl stared at him for a moment, trying to decide if he was making fun of her or not. Then, after a brief hesitation, she said,
"There aren't many polite people around these parts. Being polite means you usually go hungry."
"That may be so, but I was taught that manners don't cost anything. Nothing can be lost by using them, but much can be gained,"
he said, smiling at her, pleased with himself that he had remembered one of his grandmother's teachings so well. She looked directly at him, raised an eyebrow, and said,
"And what exactly do you think you will gain from me?"
His face instantly flushed with embarrassment as he realized how she had mistaken the meaning of his words.
No, I didn't mean it like that at all,"
he stammered, feeling his face grow even redder, if that was even possible. The girl started to smile, and when she could no longer hold back her amusement, she burst out laughing, pointing at his beaming red face.
"You should see your face. It's a real picture. It's redder than the knight's tabards."
Lusam didn't know whether to laugh or cry with embarrassment, but he settled on the former, and they both had a good laugh at his expense. Eventually, when they both calmed down enough, Lusam offered a hand towards her.
"My name's Lusam."
"Neela, pleased to meet you, Lusam," she said, still wearing a huge smile. "Are you new here? I haven't seen you around here much."
"No, actually I've been here in Hellveal for about 2 years now, since my grandmother died. But until recently I had other accommodations."
He didn't think that telling Neela he had lived inside a grate and had eaten mostly stale bread for the past 2 years would impress her very much, so he decided to skip those details entirely. After talking together for about an hour, it turned out Neela herself was quite new to Hellveal and had only just arrived there a month earlier. She had lived in the southern city of Stelgad, which she described as being even worse than Hellveal for its crime and filth, which he found very hard to believe possible. She told him of her life there, as part of a thieves' guild in the city, and how she had been taught to defend herself through the tutelage of her guildmaster and others in her guild. Neela had been, until recently, quite happy with her life in Stelgad. That was until a rival guild ambushed them and killed most of her guild members in a swift and deadly surprise attack. Apparently Neela had only managed to escape the massacre through sheer luck. The night it happened, she had been on an errand to fetch more wine for one of the guild members' birthday celebrations. She recounted the obviously painful memories of that night to Lusam. She told him that as she was returning with the wine, she could see a huge fire in the distance, and soon discovered it to be her own guild headquarters that were fully ablaze. She had tried to get closer and see what was happening, but fortunately she had noticed the men on the ground and on the rooftops above, all dressed in the dark brown cloaks of a rival guild. As her own guild members tried to flee the burning building, they were shot down mercilessly by the crossbowmen on the rooftops opposite. They had no chance of surviving, nor would the rival guild allow any to survive, as was the way of these things. No survivors meant no one to claim future revenge. Having witnessed the destruction of her entire guild with her own eyes, she knew she must leave the city immediately, or the enemy guild would find and kill her too. If she left right now, under the cover of darkness, they would most likely assume she had perished in the fire along with so many others of her guild. Neela knew exactly which businesses in the city were owned by the enemy guild, and decided to steal a horse from one of them. It wasn't much revenge for what they had just done to her friends, but at least she would cost them a horse, if nothing else. Neela had spent the next 10 days on the road, surviving as best she could, until finally arriving at Hellveal, where she sold the horse and then tried to blend in while she decided what to do next. One of the local thieves' guilds she'd approached had refused to hire her, claiming they weren't hiring any new members at the moment. But Neela knew better. The guilds were always hiring new members, simply because they lost so many members to enemy guilds and the lawkeepers. Neela knew that the real reason they wouldn't hire her was simply because they didn't know her. They feared that she might be a spy from a rival guild trying to gain entry into their organization. The big problem for her now was that after she had approached that guild and being refused entry, it was entirely foolish to try a second guild. She would almost certainly be under close observation now by several of the original guild members, just in case she actually was a spy and tried to report back to any rival guild. If she even went near another guild now, the order would be to kill her, and she knew it. Her only option left in Hellveal was to live as she was at present, on the streets, and wait until other, better opportunities presented themselves. Daylight was rapidly turning to dusk when they agreed to walk back towards the town square together. The street traders would soon be packing up for the day, and the small roadside cafes would be preparing for their evening trade yet to come. Lusam had often found that it was worth being around the stalls as they packed up. On several occasions, Lusam had been asked to help pack up stalls and had been paid a coin or two for his troubles. On more than one occasion, he had found a coin on the floor, hiding between the cobbles as the stalls were being dismantled. The coins must have been dropped by a careless patron or trader at some point earlier in the day. There was also occasionally spoiled food left by the vendors, either by accident or intentionally, he couldn't be certain. As Lusam and Neela started to walk up the cobbled street towards the town square, they saw a finely dressed man approaching from up ahead. When he was within hailing distance, he called out,
"Hey, I need one of you kids for a job! I need this letter delivering across town with the utmost urgency,"
he said, brandishing a small folded brown piece of paper with an address written on the front and a wax seal placed upon it. The address on the letter read, "T. Zachary, The Apothecary, West Helvile." Glancing at the letter in the man's hand, Lusam said,
"Sir, I know where the apothecary is in West Helvile. I can show this girl where to deliver it if you'd like."
The man looked very shocked at Lusam's statement and said,
"How can you possibly know where this letter is destined to be delivered, young man?"
"I'm sorry, I just glanced at the address on the front of your letter. I didn't mean to pry into your business, sir. Please forgive my rudeness," he said, bowing his head slightly.
"Are you trying to tell me that you can read, boy?"
the man asked, with an almost comical look of disbelief on his face. The only people who could usually read and write were the highborn, the clergy, or the scholars of this world. For a street kid to be able to read and write was unheard of. But Lusam had been taught from a young age by his grandmother, along with many other useful things.
"Yes, sir, I can read and write,"
Lusam replied, beaming with pride.
"Show me your hands, boy,"
the man said, pointing towards Lusam. Lusam tentatively showed the man his hands, wondering to himself why he would be interested in his hands at all.
"Well, I never. A street kid who can read and write and has all his fingers. Whatever next?"
the man exclaimed, shaking his head slightly.
"Well, the payment is 2 silver, one now and one upon me receiving the reply from Mr. Zachary. Do you understand?"
"Yes, sir,"
they both said at the same time.
"Good. Bring back his reply as soon as he gives it to you. I will be waiting for you at my shop in the East District. It's called the Old Inkwell. Just ask anyone for directions in the East Quarter, and they will point you in the right direction if you don't already know the place."
The man handed Lusam 1 silver coin, gave him 1 last dubious look, then turned on his heels and headed back towards the town square.
"Here's your money," Lusam said, offering the silver coin to Neela. "I'll show you where the shop is. Come, let's hurry. It'll be dark soon. It's not good to be in that part of town when the sun goes down."
"Thanks, but you keep the coin. The man said he would give us 2 silver for the delivery. That's 1 each by my reckoning. Although I could be wrong, I'm obviously not the smart one here,"
she said, with a mischievous grin on her face.
"Oh, you don't have to give me your money. You were first in line for the next job that came along. It doesn't really seem fair to take your money,"
he said, feeling his cheeks flush red again. "And I'm sure you're much smarter than me anyway," he added, grinning right back at her.
"There you go again, with those lofty ideals of yours. I've told you once already at the gate, they'll only make you hungry,"
she said, still smiling at him.
"Besides, when you arrived at the gate, I was about to call it a day anyway. So if you hadn't come by to lecture me with your high and mighty morals, I would have missed the job anyway. So it's only fair that we split the money,"
Neela replied, trying very hard to keep a straight face. Lusam stared at her for a few seconds, before realizing she was teasing him again, and they both burst into fits of laughter, playfully nudging each other as they set off walking in the direction of the apothecary. Chapter 2. Although the sun had not yet passed the horizon, it was still much darker in the narrow streets of the West District. The tall houses loomed overhead, blocking out what little daylight there was left as they cast their long shadows onto the street below. As they began walking down the damp, cobbled street in the shadows of the houses, Lusam began to realize why the man had offered to pay 2 silver coins so readily for what had seemed like such an easy job at the time. During the day, these streets were much like any other in Helvile, but at night, they were not for the faint-hearted. There were numerous brothels and seedy bars in this part of town, all setting up for the evening trade to come. Nobody walking past them so much as looked at them, let alone gave them any form of greeting. This part of town even smelled different, like a combination of rotting vegetation and old beer, with a strong smell of sewage mixed in for good measure. As they passed through a short tunnel under a large warehouse complex, known locally as the Arches, Lusan became aware of footsteps coming from behind them. He glanced back over his shoulder, but couldn't make out anyone lurking in the shadows behind them. He turned towards Neela and began to inform her in a whispered voice that he thought someone was following them. Neela turned her head towards Lusan and gave him a slight nod, letting him know that she already knew, then just carried on walking as if nothing was wrong. Lusan wasn't sure if Neela had understood correctly. Maybe she had nodded her head in answer to some other unspoken question and didn't actually know about their pursuer lurking in the shadows not too far behind them. Nervously, he leaned towards her and whispered, "I think someone is following us back there." "I know," Neela hissed back at him, sounding a little annoyed. "Keep walking and stay quiet." They both increased their speed and rounded the next corner, only to come face to face with a filthy-looking man holding a knife out menacingly towards them. When he smiled, he showed a mouth of missing and half-rotten teeth. He had a vicious-looking scar running down the left side of his face, from just under his eye to the corner of his mouth. Leering towards them, he spat to the side. Then, in a rasping voice, he said, "Give me your money, or I'll gut you both here and now." Neela took a small step towards the man, and calmly said,
"Do we look like we have money to you?"
All the time staring the man straight in the eyes.
"I suggest you put the knife away before you get hurt."
Lusan couldn't believe what she was doing. He slowly put a hand on her shoulder to try and make her see sense before either of them got hurt by this man. Neela just turned and winked casually at him, then returned her steady gaze back to the man. The man looked almost as shocked by her response as Lusan was. Then he started laughing, spat to the side again, and then said with a mocking tone in his voice,
"And who's going to hurt me, little girl? You? I want you to pay up or else, now."
Before he could finish his sentence, Lusan noticed something flash in Neela's hands. It was so fast it was barely visible. The man fell in a crumpled heap on the floor, clutching at his throat as he bled out on the cobbled street.
"I warned you too,"
Neela said to the man on the floor in front of her, now lying in a pool of his own blood, dead. Standing there in complete shock, Lusan almost didn't hear the running footsteps behind him until it was too late. As he turned, he saw a huge man flying through the air at him, brandishing what looked like a meat cleaver. Without thinking, and on pure instinct, he released a huge blast of power towards his assailant. It literally stopped the man in midair and blasted him back down the cobbled street, sending him crashing into the wall of the Arches. He hit the wall with such a sickening crunch it curled Lusan's toes, and the man sank to the floor, never to move again. He didn't need to go and see the results of what he had just done. He simply knew that nobody could have survived that kind of impact. Lusan and Neela stood there looking at each other, with equal measures of shock and awe on their faces.
"Let's get out of here, before anyone else comes. The last thing we need is the town guard being called,"
Neela said in a hushed voice. As they quickly walked away from the scene, Neela turned to Lusan and said,
"What the hell was that you did back there?"
"I can ask the same question of you," replied Lusan defensively.
"I've already told you that I grew up as part of a thieves' guild in Stelgad. You didn't think they taught me to do needlework there, do you?"
She spat back at him.
"I don't remember, however, having the conversation where you told me you were some kind of powerful sorcerer, though,"
she hissed at him.
"That's because I'm not a sorcerer. I've no idea how I even did that back there. I just panicked, and the next thing I knew, he was flying backwards into that wall,"
Lusan said, trying to match the brisk pace Neela was now setting.
"When I was younger, my grandmother taught me a few bits of magic, but nothing like that,"
Lusan said in a hushed voice.
"Oh, just like that, she taught you some magic tricks. You say that like it's the most natural thing in the world, Lusan. Magic is supposed to be only myth or legend, Lusan, not something your grandmother teaches you. We need to talk about this later. Here isn't the place. Let's just get this job done and go get paid,"
she said, looking at him warily.
"Yeah, good idea,"
he replied, as they both hurried to leave behind the shadier part of West Hellveal. As they approached the apothecary, they noticed a man leaving the shop and begin locking the door. "Looks like we're just in time," Lusan said, nodding towards the man.
"Yeah, looks that way,"
Neela agreed.
When they got closer to the man, Lusam called out to him.
"Excuse me, sir. Are you Mr. Zachary?"
The man turned his head to look at them approaching, and after taking in their shabby appearance, replied suspiciously,
"That depends who's asking, and for what reason, young man?"
Lusam smiled at the man in an attempt to get him to relax, but it seemed to have the opposite effect.
"Sorry, sir. My name is Lusam, and this is Neela. We have a letter to deliver to a Mr. T. Zachary from the owner of the old inkwell. We were instructed to bring it here to the apothecary in West Hillville and to take any reply back to him,"
Lusam replied in the most official voice he could muster.
"In that case, you're in luck. I am Thomas Zachary, the owner of this establishment,"
he replied, gesturing towards the shop behind him.
"Please hand me the letter and I'll see about that reply, young man."
"Thank you, sir,"
Lusam said, handing him the sealed brown letter. The man opened the letter and started to read the contents. After a short time, he looked up at Lusam and said,
"Please inform Mr. Daffer that I will have the items he has requested delivered to his premises in the morning by 10 o'clock, and thank him for his patronage. If there is nothing else, I would bid both of you good evening, and I'll be on my way home now. My wife will surely be waiting for me to arrive for the evening meal, and she gets more than a little upset if I keep her waiting."
Mr. Zachary nodded his goodbye. Then he turned and started walking away from them in the opposite direction.
"Must be nice to have a meal waiting for you at home,"
Neela said quietly, in a wistful voice.
"Must be nice to have a home,"
Lusam replied in a similar manner.
"Yeah, that too,"
she agreed.
"Come on. Let's go back and get paid. Then maybe we can go eat something too. I'm starving,"
suggested Lusam.
"Sounds good to me. But can we go back a different way from the way we came? By now it's a good bet the town guard will have been called, and it's probably best to avoid them if possible, just in case anyone saw us there and gave them a description of us,"
Neela said, looking a little worried.
"I'd love to avoid that area. But unfortunately, if we try to go back through the northern quarter at this time of day, we'd be arrested by the town guard for sure. Anyone who's not from the higher classes found in the northern quarter after dark is immediately suspected of criminal behaviour. And as we only have a verbal reply from Mr. Zachary, we wouldn't have any proof of why and where we were heading. As much as I hate to admit it, it's still our safest way back to the town square and then on to the east quarter,"
Lusam replied with an apologetic look on his face.
"Sounds like we'd better avoid going through the northern quarter then,"
Neela agreed.
"But if we intend going back the way we came, we had better get going before the place is crawling with guards."
They turned and started to retrace their path back towards the town square through the dark, cobbled back streets of West Hillville. Just before they rounded the corner of the area where the earlier attack had occurred, they stopped dead in their tracks and listened intently. In the distance, they could clearly hear the approaching sound of marching boots on the hard cobbles. A unit of the town guard was approaching their location, and they seemed to be coming up the cobbled streets behind them, the sounds echoing off the houses of the built-up narrow street.
"Quick, let's get moving,"
whispered Neela, as she quickened her pace towards the bend in the road, with Lusam trying to keep up with her. Acting on instinct, she glanced around the corner, before making herself visible to anyone that might be waiting there. She saw a small group of guards already at the grisly scene inspecting the bodies. Neela grabbed Lusam by his shirt and quickly pulled him out of sight against the wall.
"What's the matter?"
he asked quietly.
"Guards, lots of guards. We're trapped between them,"
she replied in a hushed voice. As they stood there trying to decide what they should do, out of the corner of her eye, Neela noticed a patrol approaching from the direction they had just come. Without a second thought, she grabbed Lusam around his neck, pulled him close to her, and started kissing him.
"At least try to look like you're enjoying yourself,"
she whispered in his ear. All Lusam could do was nod his head and give a very sheepish reply of, "Mm-mm," before Neela once again covered his lips with her own. The guards marched straight past them and around the corner without a word to either of them. Lusam's heart was beating faster than he could ever remember it doing before in his entire life. He wasn't sure if it was the close call with the guards or the shock of what Neela was doing to him. As the last guard disappeared around the corner and out of sight, Neela broke off the kiss, and with a sigh of relief said under her breath,
"That was too close."
Lusam just nodded at her with his mouth open and a dumbstruck look on his face. Although he would never have admitted it to Neela, that was the first kiss he had ever had from a girl, and a pretty girl too.
"It's okay. You can close your mouth now," she said, with a huge grin on her face. "Well, I didn't think it was possible to make your face any redder than it was at the gate earlier, but obviously I was wrong about that," she said, trying hard not to laugh at his expense. "Come on, let's get out of here. Take my hand, then let's walk past them as if we're only lovers out for a stroll. Just remember to keep smiling a lot and you'll be fine," she said, still grinning from ear to ear. "Yeah, okay," was all he could manage. And off they walked, hand in hand, as if nothing else in the world mattered, gazing into each other's eyes as they casually walked by the guards. Lusanne was acutely aware of the guards taking notice of them as they walked past, but none of them approached or asked them to stop, so they carried on walking, ignoring the guards completely. As they approached the arches where the big man's body still lay, Lusanne became aware of a man kneeling down inspecting the body. He was wearing a long black robe, black shiny boots, and had a gold chain with a symbol of some kind hanging around his neck. His skin was much darker than the average person, and it reminded Lusanne of tanned leather. Although his appearance was strange enough, it wasn't the shade of his skin or the richness of his clothing that caught Lusanne's attention most. It was the aura that surrounded the man. Not a delicate blue aura like everyone he had ever seen before, but an intense crimson aura that shone out like a bright moon in a pitch-black sky. "Keep walking," Neela hissed in his ear while pulling at his hand. Lusanne hadn't even realized he'd stopped walking, and with a quick glance at Neela, he resumed walking towards the strange man and the body. When they came within 100 paces, the man stood up and turned to look directly at Lusanne and Neela. Fear suddenly flooded Lusanne's mind. He could feel the strange man trying to gain access into his mind, and so he instinctively tried to stop him from entering. He could feel his defenses being probed for weakness from all angles, but when Lusanne realized the man couldn't break through his defenses, he visibly relaxed. Lusanne had a few moments to think before they would pass by the man. He remembered back to the game of hide-and-seek he'd played in the forest with his grandmother and decided to try and distract the man in the same way. He focused on a place further down the cobbled street, around the corner from where they had just come, and let his magic flow, projecting his aura towards that location. It instantly had the desired effect. The strange man seemed to lose all interest in them. At first he began walking very swiftly towards Lusanne and Neela, but he didn't even slow down as he walked straight past them, heading directly towards the point where Lusanne had just projected his aura. As they walked towards where the body still lay slumped against the wall, Lusanne wondered what the strange man could have been looking at so intently. Apart from the dead body, he couldn't see anything else there to hold the man's attention so long. That was until he used his mage sight to take a look, and then he couldn't believe what he was seeing. The whole area around the body pulsed with power, and even the wall where the man had impacted glowed a soft blue. It was like 1,000 blue fireflies hovering all around the area. "Incredible," he whispered. "What is?" Neela asked. "Oh, nothing. I'll tell you later. Come on, let's get out of here," he replied, not particularly wanting to start a conversation right at that moment. As they passed back under the arches, Lusanne tentatively glanced back one last time. But to his great relief, he could see no sign of the strange man with the intense crimson aura following them. And so they headed back to collect their hard-earned coin from Mr. Daffer at the old inkwell in the East Quarter. When they eventually arrived at the old inkwell, they were relieved to see a light still coming from a ground-floor window. That light meant Mr. Daffer was still at his shop waiting for them, and that in turn meant they would most likely get paid for the less than straightforward evening's work they had just undertaken. Lusanne knocked on the door 3 times, and then waited for an answer. He was just about to knock a second time when the door opened and Mr. Daffer stuck out his head. He looked both ways up and down the street and then gestured for them to quickly enter the shop, which they did. The shop was much larger on the inside than it looked from the street outside. The building stretched a long way back and had dozens of bookshelves lining the walls with all kinds and sizes of books. Lusanne had never seen so many books. In fact, he never imagined there could even be so many books in the world, let alone in one shop in Hellveal. After they had both entered the shop, Mr. Daffer quickly checked up and down the street once more, before closing the door and turning to speak with them.
"So, did you deliver my letter, boy?"
he asked, looking directly at Lusanne.
"Yes, we did, sir.
Mr. Zachary said he would deliver what you requested before 10 o'clock in the morning directly to your shop, and thanked you for your patronage, Lusam replied.
Good, good. A job well done, then. Here is the other silver coin I promised you,
he said, handing the coin to Lusam. Thank you, sir. If you need any further work doing in the future, we would be very happy to do it for you, Lusam said, maybe a little too enthusiastically.
Well, bear that in mind, boy,
he replied, with a thoughtful look on his face.
Actually, there is a job I might need help with. I recently inherited this shop from a relative of mine, and I have discovered a rather large storeroom downstairs in the basement full of books. I require them sorting out into categories and the titles recording. It's obviously a job for someone who can read and write like yourself. Call by here tomorrow at noon if you are interested in the position. There should be fewer people in the street at that time of day to see you enter my shop dressed as you are. I also need time to think of an appropriate amount of money to pay you for the job, as well as the best way to achieve the fastest results,
he said matter-of-factly. That sounds like something we could do for you no problem, sir, Lusam said with a smile.
I don't need both of you. I only need one. And as you're the only one who can read, that would be you, boy,
he said with an irritated tone in his voice. Lusam knew he was definitely in the minority when it came to reading and writing in Helvil. The fact Mr. Daffer would have to pay a scholar many times the amount he would have to pay Lusam gave him a certain amount of leverage, and that's even if he could find a scholar willing to do such a menial task. He stood there a few moments longer, then decided to take a gamble.
We're a team, sir, Neela and I. We could do the job much faster together than I could by myself, Lusam replied,
not feeling half as confident inside as he had just sounded out loud. Neela visibly shifted her stance. She, too, was surprised at what he'd just said, but to her credit, she held her tongue and stayed silent.
Is that so, boy?
Mr. Daffer said, raising one eyebrow at Lusam. The silence seemed to stretch on and on as he paced back and forth across the floor of his shop. To Lusam's great relief, it seemed that Mr. Daffer finally came to the same conclusion a short time later, when he turned to him and said,
You can both work together, but the pay is for one person only. I will pay you 3 silver a day, which you will have to share if you want the job.
Lusam looked at Neela, and she nodded her agreement to him.
We agree to your terms. Thank you, sir, Lusam said in a slightly shaky voice,
and offered his hand to Mr. Daffer, who took it in return.
Oh, and one other thing. Stop calling me sir. My name is Tom, or Mr. Daffer if you prefer,
he said with a slight smile.
Sorry, sir. I mean, Mr. Daffer, stuttered Lusam.
Just make sure you're back here tomorrow at noon and ready to work,
he said, shaking his head slightly.
We will, and thanks again,
Lusam called out, as they left the shop and closed the door behind them. With a huge smile of satisfaction on his face, Lusam started to make his way back towards the town square with Neela at his side. A few moments later, Neela suddenly stepped out in front of him, making him stop dead in his tracks.
Why did you do that back there?
She asked, with a strange look on her face.
Do what? Replied Lusam innocently.
You know full well what I'm talking about. You could easily have lost that job by demanding I had to help you. That was a damn foolish thing to do,
she said, staring straight at him. Then she surprised him even more when she kissed him on the cheek.
Thank you, Lusam. That was very kind of you. Nobody has ever done anything like that for me before,
she said, smiling at him, just before playfully punching his arm.
Now come on, let's go eat. I'm starving,
she said, and she started running towards the town square, with Lusam trying hard to catch up with her. For almost a year now, Ren had secretly followed this disciple of the dark god Amon. Ren was hoping that he would lead him to the boy mage known as Lusam, who had been lost over 2 years before when his guardian, Asima, suddenly grew ill and died. His guardian sent reports only once every year to the High Temple of Aisha to reduce any chance it may be intercepted by the agents of Amon. The reports would never contain anything as foolish as a name or description of the boy or the location he was staying. Only the bare essential information required by the high priest to judge his progress were included in the report, and even that was written in an ancient secret code only known by a select few of the followers of Aisha. It was only when the death of a minor mage was felt by the high priest and the report that was due failed to arrive that concern grew rapidly for the welfare of Lusam. Ren and the High Temple were certain he was not dead,
If he had died, his passing would also have been felt by the High Priest and other servants of Aisha. Whenever a mage child is born into the world, a great pulse is felt within the fabric of magic that surrounds all living things, by all those capable of sensing magic, both good and evil. The only thing stronger than this is the much larger disturbance felt when a mage departs this life. Asima agreed to serve Lusam's mother Samara as Hermengild, or more commonly referred to as the All-Giving. Asima, during her lifetime, had been a fairly weak mage, only capable of minor magic, but she had been well-schooled in all its forms at the High Temple. In her declining years, she willingly agreed to accept the great honor and responsibility of becoming Hermengild. Asima had only one task as Hermengild, and that was to sacrifice herself at the exact point when a mage child was born. When the sacrifice happened, the larger pulse from the death of the Hermengild would be sufficient to mask the birth of the new mage. If done correctly, the followers of the dark god Aemon would not become aware of a new mage being born, only seeing the death of a mage instead. This practice had only become necessary around 200 years ago, when it was discovered that the kingdom of Thule to the south had been secretly and systematically killing all the newborn magi they could find. It was first discovered that they had a hidden network of agents in the land of Apharon, whose sole job it was to secretly kill any newborn magi in the land. It had long been known that a birth or death created a ripple effect in the fabric of magic. What wasn't known until around 200 years ago was how the agents of Aemon managed to find the location of the birth so quickly and accurately. It was at this time that the order known as the Paladins of Aisha were used to combat the ever-increasing threat of the total eradication of magic in the lands of Apharon. Nobody knew exactly how many centuries the killing of newborn magi had taken place in Apharon, but one thing was certain. Around 200 years ago, the agents of Aemon became very good at their evil task. Magic was almost wiped out in the lands of Apharon, with no new magi to take the place of the old, as they died of natural causes and old age. It was at this time the practice of Hermengild was started by those first brave old magi to give magic a chance to survive in the lands of Apharon. Soon after, it was discovered how the agents of Aemon were able to determine the location of the birth so easily. It was discovered they each wore a magic ring capable of communicating with each other over great distances. Whenever a birth occurs, it creates a ripple outwards from the birthplace, just like throwing a stone into a pond. With the agents in constant contact with one another, they sense the ripples hit them at slightly different times and can calculate the area of the birth very accurately, also learning which one of them is closest, and therefore he or she becomes the assassin. On the day of Lusam's birth, his Hermengild arrived just in time and fully intended to perform her duty. But unknown to Samara or Asima, fate had other ideas. As Asima carefully prepared herself for the birth and her own ultimate sacrifice, custom dictated she must examine the mother magically to determine the precise time of delivery. Being just a moment or two early, or late, would result in her sacrifice failing to have the desired effect and the discovery of the newborn mage by their enemies. As she examined Samara, she discovered that she was not having a single baby as expected, but instead twins. Even more alarming was the fact that one of the babies was struggling badly to survive, even before the birth. She suddenly realized if she sacrificed herself on the birth of the first child as planned, when the second child was born, its birth would be felt by the agents of Aemon, and they would still track down the mother and newborn within a short time and kill them both. The agents searching for the baby would soon discover that two babies had actually been born, and maybe also discover the secrets of the Hermengild at the same time, and that simply could not be allowed to happen. Asima used her limited power to examine both babies in minute detail whilst still in the womb, and what she found startled her. The first baby was not formed correctly and could not survive more than a few moments after birth, but the second baby was in good health. If they were born in the correct order, the birth of the healthy baby would be felt by the agents of Aemon, closely followed by the death ripples of the second baby. If this happened, Asima would not have to sacrifice herself and could serve another mother as Hermengild, further helping magic to prevail in the land of Apharon. The problem was that the unhealthy baby was already engaged in the birthing position. She would have to reverse this and engage the healthy baby instead, using her magic and the midwifery skills she had learnt at the High Temple. Asima quickly explained the situation to Samara, who by this time was in a great deal of pain from the labor and sweating profusely. Samara agreed there was no other way and asked Asima to begin the procedure of repositioning the babies, but first she must do something for her. Samara reached up and took an amulet from around her neck, clutching it tightly until the latest contraction pain subsided. When it finally passed, and while gasping for breath, she concentrated hard and cast an amazingly complex spell on the amulet, creating an eerie glow upon it as she did so. Asima had no idea what the spell had done, and there was no time to ask for explanations at this point. Samara then grabbed hold of Asima's hand, placed the amulet in her palm, and made her swear she would give the amulet to her surviving child when he or she came of age. The old woman looked into the eyes of Samara and swore she would, but insisted she would be able to give the child the amulet herself after all this was over. Samara just smiled and gently shook her head, then insisted Asima proceed before it was too late. The repositioning of the babies was a long and incredibly painful experience for Samara. Asima was worried she would not be able to endure the procedure and that further complications would ensue from an unconscious mother, making what they had planned impossible to achieve in the time frame allowed. Amazingly, and to her credit, Samara stayed conscious, and the first child was born without further complications. The second baby, however, was far from straightforward and refused to be born. Time was running out fast. By now the agents of Aemon would have sensed the birth and be well on their way. The second baby must be born before they arrived to achieve the deception they required, and before it died naturally in the womb. Asima tried to think frantically of an alternative solution, but could not come up with one that would work in the time they had left. Samara, gritting her teeth through the pain, reached over and took hold of her hand, then reached into her belt and removed her dagger before giving it to Asima. Placing the dagger in her hand and clasping it with both of her own, she looked straight at the old woman and nodded silently. Asima knew exactly what she wanted her to do to save the new baby, and as hard as she tried, she could not think of an alternative to the grisly but only option now available to her. She bent forward and kissed Samara on the forehead, then smiling at her with tears in her eyes, sadly nodded her reply. Asima placed her hand on the mother's forehead and spoke the words of a basic spell that would put Samara to sleep while she carried out what was necessary. Moments later, the second baby was free of his mother, and as expected only survived a few breaths before peacefully passing away whilst lying against his mother's body. Asima felt the pulse of magic flow through her as the baby took his final breath, and was equally sure the agents of Aemon had also felt it. The old woman did not possess the skill to heal Samara of her wounds, even if there had been enough time to attempt it. Taking one last look back, with tears freely rolling down her cheeks, she clutched at the baby swathed in a blanket and prayed silently to Aisha for Samara's soul. Then she turned and disappeared into the woods with the newborn child. All of this information was contained in the first report sent from Asima to the High Temple. At that time it was decided that she would raise him as her own kin, under the guise of being his grandmother. She would be responsible for his safety and early training, and then when he came of age, deliver him to the temple for his more advanced training to begin. That was almost 15 years ago now, and somehow Lusam was still alive, possibly within this very city, and it was Ren's job to find him. From within the shadows, Ren looked out of the warehouse window and down onto the cobbled street below. The agent of Aemon was kneeling down, inspecting the body of a middle-aged man whose throat had obviously been cut. The agent had been eating a simple meal at an inn 4 streets away, when he suddenly stood up and left without finishing his meal. Ren had secretly followed him to this location, and after seeing the two bodies from a distance, one of which displayed the unmistakable residual effects of magic being used on it, had decided to find a vantage point in one of the warehouses above the scene. Here he stood, carefully watching the agent of Aemon from within the shadows. He suspected this man was probably a necromancer by the black full-length robe he wore, and the gold chain that held the symbol of his god Amon hanging loosely around his neck, but he had yet to see him perform any magic to be completely sure. When Ren had first arrived and looked out from the warehouse window, he had noticed a group of 5 town guards